fourth case, Tompkins v. Fisker. Mr. Green?
May it please the Court. I'm Jason Green of Jenner & Block, pro bono counsel to appellant Lee Marshall Tompkins. Your Honors, the contents of Mr. Tompkins' alleged confession were improperly admitted at his trial in violation of his right to counsel under the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution, as clearly established by the United States Supreme Court in Kirby, Brewer, and Jackson. Mr. Tompkins' Sixth Amendment right attached on the morning of March 18, 1981, when he was taken to court for his bond hearing, appeared before Judge E.C. Johnson, and specifically invoked his right to be represented at the bond hearing by a specific attorney, George Howard. In contrast, according to the police report itself, and the testimony of both Officer Houlihan and Assistant State's Attorney Perry, Mr. Tompkins' purported statement was taken during the afternoon of March 18, 1981, at approximately 1:30 p.m. Mr. Tompkins' Sixth Amendment right to counsel was violated because the statement was taken outside the presence of counsel and was initiated by police, even though adversary judicial criminal proceedings had already started against Mr. Tompkins.
I thought there was kind of a conflict in the evidence about whether he made his confession before or after the bond hearing, and the state courts resolved that in favor of the before version, that the confession, the questioning and the statement was made before the bond hearing, which occurred in the early afternoon hours.
That's correct. The state court did make that factual determination, and it is our position that that determination was an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the record that was before the state court at the time that it considered the record that was before the Illinois Supreme Court.
Well, my point is that there was conflicting evidence about that, and the court resolved it. And that's a determination that we usually don't upset.
I think that if Your Honors, while there was at least the suggestion of a conclusory statement by ASA Perry that the statement occurred prior to the bond hearing, there is an overwhelming amount of evidence that that's incorrect. Okay, so I believe that under the habeas statute, the standard is whether it's an unreasonable application or an unreasonable factual finding in light of the evidence presented in the state court. Yes, there was one conclusory statement from ASA Perry that the statement occurred prior to the bond hearing, but if you look at the rest of the evidence that was before the state court, it all suggested that the confession occurred after the bond hearing at 1:30 and that the bond hearing itself occurred in the morning. But even if you are disinclined, even if this court were disinclined to upset the conclusion that the confession occurred prior to the bond hearing, the evidence that was before the state court at the time of the first Tompkins decision at least raised the question whether Mr. Tompkins had been brought before the state court judge, the bond hearing judge, had his case continued on two occasions, and then in the interlude between the second and third phase of the bond hearing, in other words, while he was awaiting his lawyer to arrive and for the bond hearing to proceed with his lawyer there, that the confession was taken during this time period. And it's our position that if, in fact, that's when it occurred, and there's more than sufficient evidence in the record, and the state court didn't make any factual finding that it occurred prior to his arriving in court that day and his initial appearance when the case was continued, that it creates sort of a legal paradox, okay, that would be inimical to the holdings of Kirby, Brewer, and Jackson, in which the court where Mr. Tompkins was before a judge specifically invoked his right to counsel, okay, and then was questioned while awaiting the appearance of his attorney so that the bond hearing could continue with his attorney of choice. If Mr. Tompkins had declined to ask for the specific attorney that he wanted, in other words, if he had declined to exercise his right under the Sixth Amendment to the counsel of his choice, then there would be no question that his right attached immediately upon being brought into the courtroom at the beginning of March 18th, the early morning of March 18th.
I thought the scenario is he shows up for the bond hearing. Well, first of all, he hasn't been charged. The only thing that's issued against him is the complaint for preliminary examination, which is not a charging document.
That's
everybody agrees, so that doesn't satisfy Kirby. So no Sixth Amendment right attaches then. He comes in for a bond hearing. They pass the case because this George Howard isn't there. And he's offered a public defender, right?
That's correct.
And they're still waiting for the private attorney, and there's questioning that occurs while the case is sort of being pended, as I understand the chronology. Is that a fair
statement? I think that's the most fair characterization of what the state's evidence would show. If you assume ASA Perry's conclusory statement that this statement occurred prior to the bond hearing, and you're
right, and so his unequivocal invocation of the right to counsel doesn't occur until that bond hearing is actually held in the early afternoon hours.
I don't think so. I think he's brought before Judge Johnson in the morning of March 18th. He asks for the case to be continued so that George Howard, the specific attorney that he wanted him to represent him at the bond hearing, could appear with him at the bond hearing. So the paradox is that...
What is said on the record?
Well, it's...
It's not on the record.
It's in the record. It is in Mr. Tompkins' affidavit in the... Okay. In the post-conviction proceeding.
So okay. There's no transcript.
There's no transcript of the
okay.
first
so we've
two.
Got docket entries showing case passed, something like that?
No.
No, we don't have it even that.
No, we've got at the... You can find it in the record. Okay? If you look at the testimony of... if you look at the argument that was made by McGann, who was Tompkins' trial counsel, during the suppression hearing, he made this specific argument. He made the argument that at the time the confession was made, mm-hmm. okay, that he first argues that it occurred after the bond hearing. Then he later argues that, well, actually, what happened here is that it occurred after the case had been passed the first time, and that before he appeared the third time with the public defender, that's when it occurred. And that
when the statement occurred, when
that's
the statement
right.
was made.
That's right.
Right, not the invocation of counsel.
Well, the invocation of counsel.
There's an interpretive issue there.
Yes, that's right. I think that's correct.
Yep.
But I think the question that's presented to this court, though, is I don't think that this court is limited to the record that's before the court in the direct appeal. To be sure, we have argued both in the court below and in this court that it was an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented on direct appeal. But the PC court, the Illinois Supreme Court, on the appeal of Mr. Tompkins' post-conviction petition when that was dismissed, considered the merits of, or partially considered the merits of Mr. Tompkins' Fifth and Sixth Amendment claims by looking at the affidavit that he submitted in connection with the Fifth and Sixth Amendment and considered in particular whether his affidavit would change in any way the state court's decision on direct appeal, and rejected that claim, finding that the affidavit contradicted Mr. Tompkins' testimony during the suppression hearing. So under this court's decision in the Connor case, once a post-conviction court has taken a look at the merits of a claim, even if it had been considered on direct appeal, the court can consider all of the evidence anew that was before the post-conviction court. So this court is fully capable and is entitled at this point to take a look at Mr. Tompkins' affidavit and to rule that the factual finding of the post-conviction court was an unreasonable finding of fact. Since both Jackson and Brewer, the Supreme Court's decision, in those cases, it's been clearly established federal law that an appearance in court initiates judicial criminal proceedings and triggers attachment of a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to counsel. At that point, the state's relationship with the defendant has become, quote, solidly adversarial. There can be no question that Mr. Tompkins' bond hearing, where he was taken before a judge, even in the first instance, and then later informed of the formal accusation against him and sent to jail without bond, constitutes such a hearing. Michigan versus Jackson was a case in 1986 that goes directly to this point, and I think is particularly interesting because I think it informs in some way what the Illinois Supreme Court did and why the Illinois Supreme Court made the error that it did. Michigan versus Jackson was decided during the time period between briefing on Mr. Tompkins' direct appeal and when the court reached the decision in 1988. So Michigan versus Jackson, when it comes down, is now clearly established under Michigan versus Jackson that even under Michigan's dual arraignment system, in which a preliminary arraignment occurs and there are restrictions placed on a defendant's liberty and there's bond set, even if there's no formal charge at that point the defendant's Sixth Amendment right attaches and the right to counsel begins at that period of time. Under that clearly established federal law, you know, what happened in this case is basically substantially indistinguishable on the facts, in that Mr. Tompkins was brought to court for a bond hearing, had significant restrictions on his liberty, and was advised of the formal charges that against him in the complaint. That's also confirmed by Rothgary, which, although a later case in a 1983 context, looked back at all of these various cases and made the exact same determination as to whether a bond hearing whether a bond hearing in particular under or 1517, a Texas 1517 hearing, which is the equivalent of a bond hearing and a probable cause determination under Texas procedure, was the time at which the Sixth Amendment right attached. And that, again, is substantially indistinguishable with what happened in this case. I think I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Green. Ms. Stotz.
May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Rita Stotz. I'm with the Office of the Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the respondent. I disagree with almost everything Petitioner's counsel just said, and so I'll just go point by point. First, Petitioner starts by talking about the alleged confession. I'm not sure what that's relevant to, his disputing that he made the confession, but the state court found that he did. That finding is in one place where that finding was made was in the Illinois Appellate Court's last decision in Petitioner's case in 2007.
You mean it ceased to be alleged?
Pardon me?
You mean it ceased to be an alleged statement?
It ceased to be alleged. The state court found that the statement was made. Upon his arrest, Petitioner gave an oral statement to police in which he admitted his participation in the murders but attempted to shift the blame to Ronnie Moore. So the confession was made.
The reason this was an issue in the state court proceedings is because there's no written statement. The interrogating officers didn't themselves write anything down. They took no notes. There's nothing to evidence it other than their memories and their testimony later. Is that normal?
I think one reason it may have happened is that the petitioner told investigators Houlihan and Bennett that he would relay the confession to ASA Perry, and perhaps ASA Perry would have written it down at that point, but petitioner ended up changing his mind in the interim. I can't speak to whether it's normal, but I've seen plenty of other cases where the confession isn't written down for whatever reason, and the state court found that it was made. And ultimately, it's not relevant to any of the issues
right.
in this appeal.
Right.
Petitioner is also arguing now that a court appearance triggers the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, and he says that was clear under Jackson and Brewer. That's not true. Petitioner needs Rothgary. That wasn't clear until Rothgary. What the court said in Kirby in the earlier cases was that indictment, information, preliminary hearing, or arraignment triggers the right to counsel. Rothgary put a spin on that and says, well, arraignment means any court appearance, but many courts understood arraignment to be used in the way it's used in Illinois to mean a hearing where a defendant enters a plea. So petitioner really does need Rothgary to make that argument. And he says in his reply that he's not relying on Rothgary, which he can't. That would be a new rule. petitioner's also arguing that the post-conviction court's determination is the one that's relevant. That's also wrong. The state court on direct appeal resolved the Sixth Amendment claim, and petitioner attempted to relitigate it on post-conviction, but the state court said no. Now, the court did look to the post-conviction affidavit, and that was in the context of determining whether there was an exception to the res judicata doctrine. Illinois says if an issue's already been litigated, it's res judicata, unless you have new evidence that you couldn't have obtained earlier through the exercise of due diligence. So that's why the court talked about the affidavit. Of course, that affidavit isn't evidence that he couldn't have obtained earlier. Petitioner certainly could have offered all that testimony and at the suppression hearing. He just chose not to do so. So that's why the court talked about the affidavit. But then when they concluded, they said the post-conviction trial court was correct in saying that further consideration of this claim is barred by res judicata.
It was not a merits determination.
Connor is distinguishable. That was a case where the state court really did re-adjudicate a claim. And the state court's free to do that, but they didn't do that here. So it's the direct appeal determination that's relevant, and it's only of the evidence that was before the court on direct appeal that's that can be looked to under Cullen v. Pinholster. As to petitioner's point about the legal paradox, it may be true that petitioner's own actions ended up delaying the attachment of his right to counsel, but that's just a product of the way the Sixth Amendment right works. The U.S. Supreme Court is clear that the attachment of that right is based on a bright-line rule and depends on when a hearing is held or when a particular document is filed. So in this case, if the hearing is held later, the right attaches later, and that's just the way the right works. As to petitioner's point about whether he confessed before or after the bond hearing, I have a couple of points. First, as Judge Sykes pointed out, there is a little bit of a conflict in the record. That's mainly due to the fact that petitioner wasn't litigating the issue of the order of events in state court. His state court argument was that the right to counsel attached based on the complaint. And so the state court didn't need to resolve the question of which order the confession and the bond hearing appeared in. They did resolve it, but they just accepted petitioner's version of the facts. So that's one reason petitioner can't make this argument now. He clearly argued in his state court brief on direct appeal that he confessed before the bond hearing. And I have two examples. The first is at page 73 of Respondent's Exhibit A, which is the brief, where he says, the following day, which would be March 18th, at sometime between 11:30 and 1:30, as Willie Tompkins was in the lockup next to the preliminary hearing courtroom awaiting his initial court appearance, Sheriff's investigators Houlihan and Bennett, either at Perry's behest or at least with Perry's approval, entered the lockup to interrogate him. And there's also one at page 76. Indeed, at the time Houlihan and Bennett talked to him, Tompkins was in the lockup next to the preliminary hearing courtroom waiting for his lawyer to arrive and for his case to be called. So despite what petitioner says in his reply, we're not simply relying on cases where he's summarizing witness testimony or cases where he's saying it's a supposed confession or an alleged confession. Those are two straightforward examples of a clear waiver. Petitioner said the events occurred in this order. He can't now argue that they occurred in the opposite order. Regardless of how the issue is analyzed, either it's procedurally defaulted because he didn't put his current version of the facts before the state court, or it's affirmatively waived because he argued the opposite of what he's arguing now, or even under 2254D, he can't show that it's unreasonable for a state court to adopt the very facts he set forth in his brief. So once that that factual one other point is that the evidence isn't so clear-cut in petitioner's favor as he would suggest. The only thing he's relying on to suggest that the events occurred in the order he claims is an offhand reference by the court at the bond hearing that says something like, so would you like the public defender to represent you at the bond hearing this morning? It's that single reference. So that could mean, it could be a mistake, the way some people say morning when they mean afternoon, or it could just mean the court hadn't broken for lunch yet. Against that, we have Perry's clear testimony that that the confession was before the bond hearing. And there's nothing else for a petitioner to base his argument on. And as one of the questions suggested, if the evidence is in conflict, it's not unreasonable for the court to pick a side. So once petitioner, since he can't get past that factual issue, he needs to show that the state court's determination of the Sixth Amendment claim was unreasonable legally, and he seems to be conceding that the only version of that claim he raised in state court can't prevail, and that was that the complaint was enough for the right to counsel to attach. The argument that he just made, which is that his Sixth Amendment right to counsel attached because his case was called and then passed and the bond hearing was held later, that argument was first raised in the reply brief in this court. So it's forfeited. It wasn't raised in the opening brief or in the district court, and it also wasn't raised in the state court, so it's procedurally defaulted. And anyway, he couldn't prevail under 2254D on that point. He hasn't pointed to any Supreme Court law that says when a court calls a case and then passes it because not all the parties are present, that that causes the Sixth Amendment right to counsel to attach. And there are two other reasons petitioner can't prevail on the Sixth Amendment claim. One is the state court's Miranda waiver determination, which also means that he waived any Sixth Amendment right to counsel, assuming one existed at that time. What the state court found was that petitioner waived Miranda on several occasions during the March 17th and 18th period, meaning he waived it on the 17th and the 18th. Now, the only time he could have raised it on the 18th was in that interview before the bond hearing. So if he waived Miranda in that interview, he also waived any Sixth Amendment right, assuming he even had one.
Well, when we've got both rights in play, the analysis shakes out a little bit differently, though, doesn't it, in terms of who can initiate questioning? If we're talking about the Sixth Amendment right, if it has indeed attached, then the state can't initiate questioning without the attorney present. I think that's the distinction that's being drawn here. And so the Miranda waiver is separate. There's no question that he was advised of his Miranda rights before the interrogation commenced and that he waived them and made the confession. But that's a separate line of inquiry from the Sixth Amendment right to counsel inquiry, which precludes the initiation of any questioning if the right has attached. Now, I know the argument is that the right had not yet attached, and you know, that's a fairly strong argument here for the state, but if the right had attached, then the state cannot initiate questioning, which is a separate issue about whether Miranda was properly administered. You see what I'm driving at?
Is
there something wrong with that analysis?
If I understand correct, that would be an argument that Jackson would have prohibited further questioning at the time?
That's what I understand the argument to be. Right?
Okay. The problem with that is we're arguing based on the Fifth Amendment ruling as an independent bar to the current Sixth Amendment claim. So petitioner would need to say, well, the Fifth Amendment ruling was contrary to Jackson, which doesn't work. Jackson's a Sixth Amendment case. He needs to show that the Fifth Amendment ruling by the state court was contrary to Fifth Amendment Supreme Court law. And he can't do that. The argument he raised based on the Fifth Amendment in state court was that he invoked his right to counsel by accepting a telephone call from an attorney. And the state court correctly held that doesn't count for invocation. If you don't invoke, Jackson doesn't kick in, Edwards doesn't kick in, because those are rules about Those are anti-badgering rules to protect a defendant who has invoked. So if he doesn't invoke, it doesn't kick in anyway. Petitioner's argument seems to be, well, if things had worked out differently and the court had made certain rulings which it didn't make, those might have contradicted Jackson. But that doesn't help him. The court didn't make any rulings that contradicted Jackson. Jackson's no longer good law. A violation of Jackson can't get anyone habeas relief at this point, because a Jackson violation just is not a Sixth Amendment violation. The argument petitioner seems to be raising on this point in his reply brief, which is also defaulted and forfeited because that's the first time it's raised, is that he invoked his Fifth Amendment right to counsel in the morning for the bond hearing when the case was called and passed. That can't work because it's defaulted and it's forfeited, but also it's meritless. A defendant can't invoke a Fifth Amendment right to counsel in open court. The right only applies during custodial interrogation. And the court said that in McNeil v. Wisconsin. You can't anticipatorily invoke Miranda. You have to wait until you're being questioned. The third reason petitioner can't prevail on the Sixth Amendment claim is that any error in admitting the confession was harmless under Brecht. We've got the detailed testimony of Sandra Douglas about all of the events surrounding the murders, petitioner's admission to her that he hit one of the victims with a shovel. She saw petitioner rob the victims at gunpoint and tie them up. She saw the blood in the basement, and petitioner told her to clean it up, had her wash out the trunk of the car. We've also got Keith Colbreth, who says, earlier on the day of the murders, petitioner recruited me to participate in this armed robbery. I backed out when he made it clear that the victims would be killed. And then along with that, we've got the physical evidence. There's the blood found in Pamela Tompkins' basement. There's the forensic evidence about how the victims died, the gunshots, which corresponds with what Sandra Douglas testified to, the blunt force injury to one of the victims' heads, which corresponds with what petitioner told Sandra Douglas about him hitting one of the victims with a shovel. And then finally, we've got those little white styrofoam balls that are found in three places. That's in the trunk of the car used to transport the body, in Pamela Tompkins' basement, and in the victim's hair. So in light of all that evidence, the admission of the confession couldn't have had an effect on the verdict. I'll just talk briefly about the Strickland claim. And I would just ask the court to hold, because I don't know that the court has done so in a previous case, that Illinois' affidavit rule is a independent and adequate state ground. We've cited a number of cases in the brief to that effect. The rule has been consistently applied since the 60s to the present day. We've cited at least two cases specifically applying it in the context of an uncalled witness case. That would be the Smith case and the Carmichael case. This was clearly established rule long before petitioner's post-conviction petition was filed, and so that's an independent and adequate rule as to the counsel's failure to call Hayes and Pitts. And I'd ask the court to affirm the judgment.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Stas. Mr. Green.
Your Honors, I'd make three points in rebuttal. First, the Mr. Tompkins' Jackson argument is very clear. Jackson was clearly established federal law at the time that the state court decisions were made in this case. Jackson unequivocally holds that the police cannot interrogate a defendant after the Sixth Amendment right has attached. There's no factual dispute whatsoever that the interrogation at which Mr. Tompkins' confession allegedly occurred was, in fact, a police-initiated interrogation. So it is per se no waiver.
The question is not whether it's an alleged statement. It's a question of whether it's admissible. The question of whether it's existing police, not an issue before.
Right, I understand. I'm not making the argument that...
I just hate the word allegation because it's been abused so much.
Second point, Your Honors, is that the reference to the invocation in the morning, there's more evidence than the suggestion made by the state was that there's no evidence at all, and that the only reference to the invocation in the morning was the single reference that the judge made to this morning. The judge actually makes that reference twice on the record. Mr. Tompkins also makes the reference once on the record. So there's three references. Once might be a mistake. Three separate times is not a mistake. They all refer to this morning in the in the transcript of the bond hearing. There's also the testimony of Mr. Perry himself at the bond hearing, and this is in the supplemental appendix at page 185 and 186, and this was cited to the court on direct appeal. Perry testified that when asked about when a person is charged, he said, "A person is charged when the file is before the court and the man has appeared in, stepped in front of the judge. I would say that was the initiation of the charges against a man, when he's advised by of the charge by the court." Perry then, in the next sentence, says, "This happened in the vicinity of 12:31 or 1:15. So there's no dispute that Mr. Tompkins actually invoked his right during the bond hearing, and Mr. Perry said it happened at 12:31 or 1:15. The final point is that the Illinois Supreme Court, in its decision, the argument was much more nuanced than counsel is suggesting. The argument was, in addition to the complaint argument, Mr. Tompkins argues, "It is indisputable that the following day, when Mr. Tompkins supposedly gave an inculpatory statement to Houlihan and Bennett, adversary proceedings against Mr. Tompkins were at full force. He'd been brought to the Markham courthouse that morning by Bennett for his initial court appearance and bond hearing." So even in rejecting the complaint argument, the court at that point had the burden to respond to the other argument, which was in the direct appeal brief that the right had attached sometime on the morning of March 18th. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Thanks to all counsel, and an additional thanks to Mr. Perry, Ms. Mashrin, and Ms. Perry for accepting the responsibility in this case. The court appreciates that. Case is taken.